Hi, I'm John Rawling, welcoming you to Ringside Rewind, where I'm joined by Tris Dixon and Ian Dark. And we're grateful for sponsorship from Fleet UK, a car and commercial vehicle leasing company based in Hampshire, supporting our programme. Great people who've supplied customers for 20 years or more, including me. Wherever you are, they'll find and supply any car you want and work out financing options to best suit your needs. Fleet UK pride themselves on transparency, trust and fairness in every deal. And you can take it from me, they are brilliant at what they do. Just have a look and check them out at fleetuk.com.
Hello and welcome back to Ringside Rewind with me, Tris Dixon, Ian Dark and John Rawling. Thank you so much for the feedback that you've given us so far on our earlier episodes. And if you can, please go to iTunes or wherever you listen to your podcasts and rate and review Ringside Rewind. This week, we're talking about none other than a British boxer, a British sporting hero and legend, Ian, Frank Bruno. He's one of the most popular sportsmen ever from the UK, isn't he?
Yeah, he is. He's the national treasure and people still love him long after he's stopped boxing. It's the only comparable boxer I can think of really in my time is Henry Cooper, who attained that level of popularity. I mean, if Frank walked into any arena now, and not just a boxing arena, everybody would burst into applause, and they'd probably do that Bruno, Bruno chant. So I covered all his career. I saw it with all the foibles and the doubts and the disappointments that he had, and it was a wonderful night when he at last did become world heavyweight champion at Wembley.
John, what was behind his connection with the audience?
I think the fact that he was, he came across as a very, very affable man. I mean, he looked the part. He had a fantastic physique and he looked every inch the heavyweight boxer. His fights, particularly his early fights, were on a very regular basis, albeit against very moderate opposition on BBC television. And he established a great rapport with Harry Carpenter, the commentator. Harry would commentate on Frank's fight and then they'd have a sort of a knockabout routine afterwards, and the public grew to love him with his "know what I mean, Harry" type asides. And he, as Ian says, he grew into public consciousness and he did become kind of a national treasure. It seemed as though everybody knew him.
Yeah. I mean, you're being kind when you say that the early opponents were modest, John. It brings to mind a story. One of them was a guy called Jeff Jordan, and they'd announced the fight that morning. And on the posters, it said, "Jolting Jeff Jordan." And I thought, blimey, really? Mike Barrett, of course, it was Mickey Duff's sidekick, said to me, "Oh, Jeff will be in our office at 4 o'clock if you want to get an interview with him ahead of the fight." So I turn up at the office. He's fighting Bruno, and he's there, and he's with this sort of a Midwestern kind of drawl. And I said, "Oh, are you Jeff Jordan?" He goes, "Yeah." He goes, "Says that, mind if I do a little interview with you for the BBC?" He said, "Oh, yeah, I'd love that." He goes, "I've never been on the BBC." So I said, "First of all, tell us about this nickname, Jolting Jeff Jordan." And he goes, "I don't know about that." He goes, "Jolting Jeff Jordan, is that what they're calling me? Hey, well, I kind of like that." He goes, "Hey, I might stick with that nickname." They completely invented it to try and sell the fight, you know, because all these guys are like casino guards, wasn't there? Casino guard from Carson City, Harvey Steakin, and, you know, people who had been on club fights. I mean, they looked around for anybody who was barely breathing, I think, in those early fights. Of course, Frank knocked them all over in a round or two, didn't he? But, you know, hey, look, that's what promoters do to build up fighters. And it was a brilliant marketing exercise, as you said, John. It was peak time on BBC One. So it was an easy sell.
Well, he signed with Terry Lawless, didn't he, when he was 18 years old. And we know that Terry was almost like a father figure to him, Tris.
Yeah, and I mean, in terms of the regularity, it's something that we just don't see today. I mean, there's a bunch of fights here, I think towards the end of 1982, where he fought in the end of October, twice in the space of 2 weeks in November and then early December. So four fights in about 6 weeks, all at prime time on the BBC. Can you imagine a prospect coming through? And I mean, they're struggling to have four fights in a year, let alone four fights in a month or two.
No, he was certainly kept incredibly busy. But they got it wrong a couple of times, didn't they? I mean, I remember he'd been bowling everybody over, and you talk about it was literally a sort of a fight a month or more. But then in his 19th fight, having leveled the lot of them, he came up against a guy called Floyd Cummins, fought him at the Royal Albert Hall. And remember that one? And you can tell everybody why they called him Jumbo Cummins.
Swiftly moving on.
Well, he got whacked at the end of the first round, Frank, and then he was in all sorts of trouble in the second as well. Eventually, he came through it and won, but that was the real first big test of his chin.
Well, the other thing that happened in that fight, if you remember, John, was that Terry Lawless, I mean, because Frank was kind of out of it. He was swaying like an oak tree in a hurricane in the middle of the ring, and Terry Lawless ran out the corner and grabbed him and brought him back to the corner. I mean, he should have been disqualified, frankly. But, you know, hey, it was Frank Bruno and they were building him, and the ref turned a blind eye to it a bit and he got away with it. And as you say, he went on to win the fight. But, it was a massive scare. I mean, I don't think Cummins was anything special at all, but he just caught Frank, didn't he, with a few punches. So he got through that scrape. He probably should have been disqualified that night.
So, Ian, let me ask you this. When was Bruno taken seriously from the start as a fighter? Or was it a question of what are they protecting him from in terms of the matchmaking?
No, I don't think there was too much of that. But I mean, I think the view was that the public found him that, as John has very well explained, he had this kind of gauche charm, and he did those interviews with Harry in the ring, and you know what I mean, and it became a big routine, and the belly laugh, and all that. But the public, they weren't that interested in what the credentials of the opponents were. All they saw was this very well sculptured fighter knocking out people in a round. And of course, you know, you were in an era then, you know, this was before Lennox Lewis or anybody else had made any impression at all on the heavyweight world stage. And the sale line was that one day Frank might be a future world champion. And people, I think the public, you know, the mostly non-boxing fans, were quite happy to believe that. I think the view in the trade among the reporters was that he was too robotic, he was too programmed, and really quite raw. And Terry Lawless and Mickey Duff and Mike Barrett, et cetera, they all knew that, which is why they had to bring him along very, very slowly. I mean, that was a smart move because, he had the L plates on. Things could go wrong. They did go wrong nearly that night against Jumbo Cummins. So it was a marketing exercise to build him up and build up this narrative that maybe one day, you know, Frank would be world heavyweight champion. There was this story they put out about how, you know, he'd gone to the problem school for problem kids in Sussex when he was a boy. And, you know, and there was a dusty mirror and his brother had written on there, Frank Bruno, world heavyweight champion. And so all those stories came out. And I don't think Frank was totally comfortable with it all. He wasn't comfortable with the media spotlight at all. I don't think so. Yeah, but much, you know, those interviews with Harry kind of happened by accident. He grew into it and then started to play the part. But I mean, it was a lovely story and it was built up. But he was, I think, you know, among the boxing press at that time, he was regarded as pretty robotic and programmed, and that one day he'd get found out.
And it was only about, what we were talking about, 1983, you fought your man Jumbo. And then three fights later in May 1984, he came unstuck against Bone Crusher Smith. And, you know, I mean, you kind of have a little bit of sympathy with the matchmakers, because we're talking here about an era before, long before social media, YouTube, et cetera, et cetera. And there were these guys over in America who supposedly knew all the rankings, knew all the people who could beat everybody else, knew where to find the bodies in the graveyard to come out for an easy pushover. And sometimes they got it wrong. You know, you can't check like you couldn't check then like you can now. There's no such thing as a con job now in terms of ratings and rankings, because everybody who's interested in boxing gets on YouTube and looks at the form of the guys involved. So everybody makes their own mind up, just as years ago, decades ago, Mickey Duff as matchmaker would for Frank Bruno. But it all went horribly wrong with Bone Crusher Smith.
Yeah, it did. I mean, he fell apart late in the fight that night. It's interesting, John. They got to a point, I think, with him where they felt, okay, we've just got to step him up a little now. I mean, Bone Crusher Smith was good enough to have gone the distance with Mike Tyson, remember? So it probably was a miscalculation. Bone Crusher inflicted his first defeat. I remember that night very, very clearly. I think the fight was on a Sunday night. For some reason, I can't remember it this far ahead. But also on the bill was another of their big prospects, Mark Kaler. So Frank got beaten, and Mark Kaler got beaten by Buster Drayton on that.
Very good fighter.
And Terry Lawless did an interview with me afterwards and said, "That's it. I'm finished with boxing. I can't take this. I'm very emotional. You know, all this has happened on one night." I mean, he retracted it about 48 hours later and thought, well, I've had another think about it. And, you know, these things happen and we can rebuild. But he was that distraught about what had happened that night that he was in the mood to quit boxing. But, you know, Terry was that kind of a guy. He kind of fell in love with his fighters, which he freely admitted. And it did look then, you know, just for that night, like that was the end of the dream, really, that for Frank Bruno, that the story might be coming to a premature end. Of course, there were several chapters still to write.
Bone Crusher was a big miscalculation, wasn't he? I mean, Frank boxed really well that night, I remember. He was well ahead on points when he came into the last round, into the 10th round. You know, and people talk throughout his career about Frank's chin. It was rather more, I thought, that when he got hit, he didn't have an automatic sort of thought process about how to defend. He'd get smacked on the chin and become instantly wide open and vulnerable. Rather than having a bad chin, he was left open when he got tagged. And also, he had that big, at that stage, I think, that very definite stamina problem. So in the latter stages of fights, that's when he became vulnerable. And that's what happened against Bone Crusher, who as the record books tell us, and we both saw, Ian, he knocked him out, stopped him in that last round.
Yeah, I mean, I think you've said it, John. You got it spot on. I think he lacks survival instincts, Frank. I mean, it would have been better almost if taking that sort of punishment, he'd gone down and taken an 8 count. But he stood there, didn't he, and dropped his gloves usually, and then he was just sitting there waiting to be hit. And that, you know, brought about the end of the fight. So that was the problem that was going to continue to haunt him, of course, you know, because if you fast forward a little bit to his first world title attempt against Tim Witherspoon, again, he boxed well, looked like he might be on his way to winning the fight, but faded late on and got caught, and same thing.
I guess this is all a bit before your time, Triz, isn't it? But you must have heard all the stories when you started developing an interest in boxing.
Yes, it is. I mean, Bruno is one of the names and faces of my childhood. So, yeah, I mean, I wasn't obviously there, but I was watching it all on TV and swept up on it. And like you say, you know, I remember obviously the stuff with Harry Carpenter turned into adverts for HP Source and different things like that. I remember the different TV commercials and the different things that they would get out of it. And yeah, I mean, it was great. I remember one of the early fights that I did see was when he wiped out Jerry Coetzee, the South African.
Yeah.
And that was in a round before that he fought Witherspoon. And I think in history, that's probably an underrated win because Coetzee was useful. He was only, I think he'd won 30 and lost 4 or 5 by that point. And Bruno absolutely starched him, didn't he?
Well, the tremendous knockout power. He really could hit Bruno.
I mean, Coetzee was WBA champion, wasn't he, for a while? I don't remember the exact chronology, whether that was before or after that fight. But truth to tell, I think, about that fight now, Coetzee, I think, pretty clearly was kind of on a holiday with his family in London. So I wasn't too surprised because I'd heard the stories about, let's put it this way, one or two corners have been cut in the training. So it was a great win for Frank and a great name to get on his record. They were stepping up the level of opponents by then. I mean, he won the European title against Anders Ekland, didn't he? That was another kind of fight on the rebuilding phase. But, you know, that night against Tim Witherspoon, that was at Wembley. I remember Witherspoon's, he had about 80 people around him on his way to the ring, all chanting out, "Let's get terrible, Tim! Let's get terrible, Tim!" I mean, he was a lovely guy. I mean, we all got to know him a little bit later. Lovely guy, Tim Witherspoon. And Frank was going well. I was doing the commentary for BBC Radio, little story, that night. And I was pretty nervous because this was about the biggest fight I'd ever covered till then. You know, I hadn't been doing it too long at that point. Blow me if they, without telling me, they brought in Eamon Andrews to sit behind me with Peter Jones to be on the programme. And I'm thinking, oh, my God, this is like the doyen of boxing commentators from way back. You know, he's gone on to be this kind of megastar. And I've got him sitting thinking, you know, I bet he's thinking, well, what's this little whippersnapper? You know, who's he to do the commentary? I felt like I was being assessed with him sitting behind me the whole night. But
you're talking about the guy who did Don Cockle and Rocky Marciano back in 1953 or something. I mean, he was one of the great voices of BBC Radio sports commentary, Eamon Andrews.
He was the original presenter of Sports Report when it started in 1948. I mean, as it turned out, I needn't have worried. He was a lovely guy and charming and very complimentary afterwards and all that. But I wish they'd told me he was going to be sitting beside me.
Probably have had a nervous breakdown.
So, John, let me ask you this. So after the loss to Witherspoon, how much was the bloom off the rose for Bruno and the Bruno bandwagon, given that he'd sort of fallen apart twice late on? Was this his level? Was this as far as he was going to get, or was there still optimism and enthusiasm?
Well, no, that was precisely what people were thinking, Triz, after that. You know, I mean, Ian talked about Jerry Coetzee being on a holiday. I remember going down to the training camp of Tim Witherspoon before the fight. Muhammad Ali was over there with him. So that was pretty much the first time I'd had the chance to sort of sit down and talk to Muhammad Ali, who by that stage in 1985 was already very much a shell and a shadow of what he'd once been. But he was around the place. But there was this party atmosphere around there. And Witherspoon, when you looked at him, clearly was in nothing like the physical shape that Frank Bruno was. I don't know how hard he'd trained, but he looked soft. He didn't look, you know, you talk about the eye of the tiger. He didn't look as though he had that. But, you know, Frank unraveled in that 11th round against Witherspoon. Witherspoon got the knockout. And really, that fight and that opening for Frank had been beautifully crafted. And that should have been his night. And before the knockout came, it looked as though it was going to be his night. But the fact that he lost in the manner that he did, I think a lot of the experts, you know, there were some pretty cynical and high-powered writers back in those days, people like Frank McElvany, Ken Jones, and some of the other heavyweight writers, Wooldridge, for instance, on the Mail, and a lot of them at that stage were saying, well, this is a manufactured fighter. We've now seen him at his level, and when he gets pushed onto the higher plane, he can't cope.
Ian, what's your take on where Bruno was emotionally after that fight, you know, having lost to Bone Crusher and Witherspoon? Do you think that he had the same doubts?
I don't have any great insight into what was going on in Frank's mind at that time. I think he was always quite a complex individual, and he had one or two, even back then, sort of imagined demons as well. I remember him saying to me once that he had to be careful because he thought he was a target of the IRA. I don't think there'd been any intelligence, but in his head, that's what he thought might happen to him. At that stage, to be fair to all the writers and the big names there in the media that John has mentioned, I think probably that was an accurate assessment of where Frank was at that time, that he developed more talent. He wasn't, you know, he wasn't quite the guy in the L plates anymore. He developed to a fringe world level type of fighter, but probably wasn't going to be able to take the last step. So it was a case of trying to rebuild him yet again. I mean, great credit to him, his mental fortitude. I mean, I suppose a lot of fighters might have mentally given up the ghost a little bit, having, you know, what had happened with Bone Crusher and what had happened with Witherspoon. But he was always determined that one day that the dream would become reality. He always had, and he trained and trained and trained. I don't think there aren't many fighters who trained as hard as Bruno. And he loved doing the training as well. He looked after himself in you know, he was in immaculate condition. I remember he gave me a lift once from the Royal Oak gym, Terry Lawless's gym in Canning Town, back into the middle of London. He said, yeah, hop in the car. So I hopped in the car alongside him and I looked at the back seat. And honestly, it was like a grocery store. It was stacked with apples and oranges, pears, all kinds of vegetables. I said, what's this, Frank? He goes, oh, this is all part of my diet. He goes, I always have it handy. I mean, honestly, you know, it was like your local greengrocers. But I mean, I always got on fine with him as well. I mean, he used to call, I mean, I didn't have the sort of, you know, it wasn't like the thing that went on with Harry Carpenter, which obviously was a big sell point for him. But I had rather more hair than he used to call me Perm Boy. He'd say, hey, Perm Boy, what do you want? he still calls me that. Well, last time I saw him was a few years ago now. He still remembered that because he had this amazing memory as well. He knew things about the families of the reporters on the boxing beat as well. I remember, I think Ken Gorman sort of told him the name of one of his kids, and sort of Frank sort of astounded him one day by sort of saying in the gym, turned around to him and said, you know, how's Dave or whatever it is, his kid's name was, you know, like he'd remembered it. So he said, I can't believe he suddenly plucked that out of the air. So there's just a few insights into what Frank was like. And it wasn't just the public who loved him. Although we criticised and thought he had his limitations as a fighter, I think we were all kind of in on the story. And you know, as a media person, you want the narrative to develop and the story to happen, don't you? I think we too, you know, hoped that one day it would happen.
I got the impression that Frank was always a little bit wary of the guy who was very much a part of our team, Ian, Henry Cooper, because, you know, I mean, we've been there numerous times when Henry's been there talking about Frank Bruno. And I think it's only fair to say that Henry was very sceptical about his abilities.
Yeah, I think he probably was. Yeah, because and Frank wasn't, John, was he? He wasn't a natural. He was a taught fighter. But I think it's fair also to say he learned pretty well. You know, it was a long way from where he was in those early fights and how he behaved to where he got to in a later point in his career. And for me, the high point was the Lennox Lewis fight. You know, I think he boxed beautifully that night and was winning the fight. But we'll get to that one.
Yeah, sure.
By the time we got to that stage, we'd all sort of started getting to know Frank pretty well, Triz. And it became apparent, you know, the more you spoke to him and the more you understood him, that there was a lot more to Frank, and he was a lot deeper on many levels than the sort of the pantomime figure that people like to think he was when they saw him alongside Harry Carpenter. But there's a lot more to Frank than that. He was a lot deeper.
Mm. It's interesting you mentioned the pantomime thing, because obviously that was a huge thing as well, wasn't it? He was, you know, year in, year out, he was a regular on a pantomime. I'm not sure we'd see Anthony Joshua doing that these days.
When I think back to the very first fight he had as a pro, we were all invited to the press conference. It was some swish club in London. And I went up to Frank. I mean, this is how sort of naive and gauche he was at the time. I said to him, could I record an interview with you for BBC Radio 2, as it then was? And he says to me, he goes, what do you mean? I said, well, I'll ask you some questions, Frank, and then you answer them. He goes, right. He said, I'm just going to go and ring my mum. I said, what? He said, to tell her to switch the radio on. I said, no, it's recorded, Frank. We'll record it now. It'll be on at 6:45 tonight on our sports desk. Right, so I go to start the interview, and before I've asked the first question, Frank grabs the microphone off me and says, I'm going to knock him out in the first round. So I only tell that story to witness. He didn't really have any idea about how you behaved and did interviews or anything like that. And he graduated to become this guy who was a star of pantomimes and pretty big box office later on. So he grew into his celebrity status. I remember another thing he did was that little publicity gig they did with him. They had him doing tap dancing with Roy Castle. And the line was that this was going to improve his footwork. Of course, it was just a PR stunt, but Roy Castle was happy to play along with it. But, you know, he became A-list.
So, you know, we talked about the Witherspoon fight. On his road back, he beat James Tillis, he beat Chuck Gardner, he beat Reggie Gross. And then he had this big fight at Tottenham with Joe Bugner, John.
Yeah, that was coming up. I mean, Chuck Gardner and Reggie Gross were two apps, and Chuck Gardner particularly was an absolute stiff. You know, he was dreadful, and Reggie Gross was not much better. So they were absolutely hand-fed to Frank Bruno to try and make him look relevant again, although he had picked up a decent win against James Quick Tillis in his first comeback fight. But then he had these two bowlovers, which set the scene for Joe Bugner in, what was it, 1987, big open-air fight at White Hart Lane. The involvement of Barry Hearn with that one, who'd adopted Joe Bugner. And, you know, I mean, Bugner was way, way, way past his sell-by date by then. But he played the part. He knew how to talk a fight. He knew how to sell a fight. And so it became a big fight, didn't it, Ian?
Honestly, I can't remember his exact weight for the fight. But, you know, he resembled a beached whale, to be honest. And Frank did a number on him, took him apart, really, in eight rounds. Great atmosphere, though, that night. You know, it was a big, big sell. And it was a good notch that on, you know, in the public's mind, in terms of sort of rehabilitating him. I think, you know, he's saying, well, Frank's on the way back. Look, you know, he's beaten Joe Bugner. But, you know, people didn't really care that it was a pretty ancient Joe Bugner. But Frank did it well that night.
And so by then, Mike Tyson had become the man of the heavyweight division, Tris.
Well, let me just ask you this. Do either of you know who Henry Cooper was rooting for the night Bugner fought Bruno?
That's an interesting question.
Very good question. We'll never know the answer either.
Okay, so we mentioned Tyson there, so let's get to Tyson, which is the first fight where Bruno goes over to Vegas. After, there's a lot of speculation, and I think the fight was going to take place over here originally, right? Do you remember that? Do you remember the fight was coming to England? I think Mike Tyson came over and did some publicity work and was pictured with police officers and that kind of stuff, and then it never happened. I think maybe Tyson got injured or Bruno got injured and it wound up going to Vegas.
They were very keen to get Tyson over here. I mean, Jarvis Astaire was the big player back in those days and involved. And Frank Warren as well would have been very keen to have had a piece of that if they could have got Tyson over here, because the Tyson bandwagon by then had really started to roll. We're talking about the youngest ever world heavyweight title, and he had this intimidating aura, Mike Tyson. And the thought of Frank Bruno going in against him, I think people almost feared for Frank. But having said that, he was the man to beat Tyson. And have they been able to make that over here, it would have been a huge, huge fight. But as it happened, it didn't turn out that way. So we all had to go to Vegas in 1989.
Yeah, and that fight was massive as well, wasn't it? It was a huge fight. There were so many British media who made the journey over for that. This was, you know, Frank's attempt again to become world heavyweight champion. As John said, Tyson's reputation was awesome at that point. There were one or two signs looking back in retrospect that things were just beginning to go wrong for Tyson. All the stuff with Robin Givens, you know, who was the gold digger, wasn't she? You know, and there'd been other stuff with Tyson, but it was regarded, the fight, as a formality. I remember the build-up to it. Frank, they'd obviously worked on a PR line for Frank, and he came out at every press conference and sort of overused it and said, you know, Mike Tyson thinks he's Superman, but I got kryptonite. And that was his line. And so I remember he's trotted it out again at the final press conference before the fight, and somebody said to Tyson, what do you think about this, Mike? What do you think about the kryptonite? And Tyson goes, "Oh, we've heard this so many times before. We'll see Saturday." he was bored with the whole rigmarole. I think he regarded it as a bit of a formality as well.
You talked about the cracks in Tyson, though, Ian. You know, we look back now from all these years on, and we all have 20/20 vision with hindsight. But I can remember in the run-up to that, people were almost fearful of what Tyson could potentially do to Frank Bruno. You know, I mean, he still had that very much that aura of invincibility. He'd annihilated Spinks. And now was coming up to Frank Bruno and Spinks. There were a lot of people who looked at Spinks and said, you know, this is the guy who gave Larry Holmes all the trouble he needed. And this was a very, very real fighter. And a lot of people thought that Spinks could have beaten Tyson, but it didn't turn out that way, did it?
Yeah, 91 seconds blew him away. But you know, do you remember by then, though, Tyson had, you know, it wasn't a great team in his corner. He had Jay Bright, who was a former actor, and a bloke called Aaron Snowell, who none of us really knew. So he was a long way from, you know, when he had people like Kevin Rooney working the corner. So, yeah, you're right. In retrospect, you look at it and you think, yeah, well, maybe, you know, he was just already beginning a kind of downslope. But, I mean, he got, I think I've told the story before in one of our earlier editions, he got the biggest audience they'd ever had in the middle of the night on Radio 2, because it wasn't on any of the big channels in the UK at the time. So, yeah, everybody got up in the middle of the night and listened to that fight. And it was shown the next day, wasn't it, on BBC One with Harry Carpenter's famous "Get in there, Frank."
Do either of you have any insight about Bruno's belief going into that first fight? Obviously, the second one we'll get to, but the first one, John, do you really think that Bruno thought he could win against a 35-0 Mike Tyson?
I mean, Ian might tell you differently, but I don't believe he did think he could win. Tyson launched a huge onslaught early in the fight. And we kind of thought, well, here we go. It's going to be over very quickly. But then there was that moment when Frank caught him, and he did catch him. He did stun him. And the bell came, well, at the right time for Mike to see him through there. And Harry Carpenter at ringside knew that he'd got him going. And I think for that moment, then the realization grew within Frank that maybe he could just pull off what would have been a huge upset. But I'm not convinced that he ever really thought he could win.
I agree with you, John. I don't think he thought he could win, and I don't think Terry Lawless really thought he could win. Of course, they had to tell a different story when they were doing the interviews ahead of the fight, but I think in their heart of their hearts that I think they were happy. If you remember, I mean, the nightmare scenario for the Bruno camp was that he'd be beaten in 30 seconds or something like that, and it would be embarrassing. As it was, he went five rounds and he had that big moment, and he didn't follow it through. I don't think he realized he'd hurt Tyson in the way that he had with that shot in the first round, and didn't really follow it up. And that gave Tyson a bit of recovery time. But, you know, it was a single moment in what was five fairly one-sided rounds. But when Frank came home from that fight, and the way it was reported was that he put in a pretty good shift. You know, people, I mean, Tyson, you know, Mike Spinks had been blown away in 91 seconds. Bruno had done okay and shown that he had improved, you know, to go that long. Not many people by that stage had gone that far with Tyson.
Stopped in the fifth round, wasn't he?
Yeah. So, John, let me ask you this. So, I mean, I don't like this phrase, lovable loser, but in some ways that loss to Tyson would have endeared Frank even more to the British public, because there was this thing where he was going to be the nearly man and everyone loved him. Everyone was willing him over the line to get a world title fight. So in some ways the loss endeared him even more.
Well, yeah, I think that's certainly true, because we all massively respect bravery in the face of overwhelming odds, don't we? And that was very much a case of that, because I don't think too many people, I can't remember what the book was over in Las Vegas, but Tyson would have been an absolutely huge favorite. So I don't think too many people outside boxing, or, you know, just fans, thought that that Bruno had any real chance. And the fact that he'd had the balls, for want of a better word, to go in there against Tyson and to get the feared man going when he tagged him, I think people thought, well, hey, here's a guy who gives it a go. And I think there is an element of the fact that because of that, we loved him even more.
Yeah, I think you can enhance your reputation sometimes in boxing in a brave defeat. And it was quite a brave defeat, really, by Frank. You know, he came back with his head held high. I remember there was a bit of a kind of kerfuffle at the time that Frank had come back to this huge hero's welcome, and Dennis Andres had won the world light heavyweight title in Tucson, Arizona, around the same time. And he came back, you know, and walked without being recognized through the airport. And one or two people reflected on that, but, you know, they were different levels in terms of profile. Poor old Dennis, I remember he turned up at the next press conference and he brought the world title belt in a carrier bag with him.
And traveled on the tube, didn't he?
On the tube, that's it. That was the one. Yeah, I mean, Dennis, we're digressing a bit here, but Dennis, I remember when Dennis won that world title in Tucson, he lined up glasses of champagne on the bar and said to all the press guys who traveled to see him, he said, thank you all for coming. I'm going to bed now. He said, I'm just going to have an orange juice. He goes, but help yourself to the champagne. So I thought that was handsome.
Let me ask you this. Just one word answer from you both before we move on. Get in there, Frank. Good boxing journalism or not good boxing journalism? John?
Not.
Ian?
And now I think we've had this conversation in the past. I think it was justified given that where Harry and Frank Bruno were, and he was broadcasting to a British audience. So fair enough by me.
So that's one word.
No, I like it. I like it. I mean, I suppose what he's saying is only Harry could have got away with that, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So the rebuild after Tyson, we have, well, I say the rebuild, there's what, 18 months, a couple of years before he comes back against John Emmon.
And dreadful fighter.
Well, he had to be, didn't he? Right. He was never going to be brought back against a world beater after the Tyson fight and such a long layoff. But I suppose the bandwagon has stopped rolling by this point, though. People, you know, Bruno's still a brand and he's still a national treasure, but the belief has gone out of the Bruno story. Is that right, John, by this point?
Yeah, it had. And he leveled John Emmon as he was always going to. That was a first round stoppage, and it was a bit of a farce of a fight at the Royal Albert Hall. And then they moved on from there against a guy from South America, Jose Ribalta. That went, he got another quick win there, but they started to move up a bit, and it was kind of a rebuilding of Frank's belief as well as public belief, because he came through Pierre Coetzee, who is a decent, you know, not a bad heavyweight, and then he had a very good win against Carl Williams, who was a little bit of a name, and he went and won that by technical knockout at the NEC in Birmingham. I remember being at that one, and that, I think, after that night, Ian, that was a night when people started to think, well, maybe Frank's not finished after all. Maybe he still, after those two setbacks, he still has something to offer.
Yeah, I mean, the story just went on and on and on, didn't it? You kept thinking, well, that's it, really. The story's coming towards its natural end. But as I said, he was very, very dedicated to the cause and found new belief and kept coming back. And yeah, he did blow away anybody below the top level. You show him anybody below the top level, he was going to win. I mean, you mentioned that Jose Ribalta fight and you just jogged my memory, John. I just rushed from the hospital to do the commentary for that fight because my daughter Kath was born that very day of the Jose Ribalta fight, which I've shown her since then. And I said, your birth was mentioned an hour after you were, or 2 hours after you were born on Radio 2, because the presenters said, and your commentator tonight, and he's just rushed from the hospital where his daughter's been born. I was feeling in a pretty good mood that night.
Blimey, and so was Frank, but then, you know, after that fight with Cole, the Truth Williams, he gets the Lennox Lewis fight. It's in the National Stadium in Cardiff. I'm sure you were both there. Ian, he started well enough against Lewis, didn't he?
Oh, very, very well. I mean, it was a very rainy night in Cardiff and it was cold. And I don't think Lennox really liked the conditions. He was fighting in open air and he was very slow out the blocks. And Frank looked in great condition. He was as fluent as I ever saw him look. He really did box fluently and beautifully that night. He got his jab working. He was winning the fight. There's no question about that. He was winning that fight and he was a revelation, I think, in the first half of that contest. But, you know, again, yet again, the story went wrong for him.
There was bad blood in the run-up to that fight as well. And Frank, if you remember, I think Lennox had been interviewed somewhere, and whether he said it or he didn't say it, I suppose the people involved know that. But the story which came out in the press and which reached Frank Bruno was that Lennox had said that Frank Bruno was an Uncle Tom, and that he danced to the white man's tune and wasn't a proud black man. Now, to a man such as Frank Bruno, not surprisingly, he construed that as a massive personal insult.
Yeah.
Well, I interviewed Frank for Boxing Life Stories, and we touched upon this, and he still got some resentment towards Lennox for the barbs that flew his way back then in 1993. John, same thing. Obviously, it's a fight that Frank was winning. Was there a feeling in your mind that he was going to unravel, or did you think this is the night he's got him here?
Well, I remember clearly the fight. We did the commentary, and it was a foul, filthy, wet night at the in open air at Cardiff Arms Park, and we really thought at one stage it was touch and go whether it was going to go ahead. Even people were sliding around on the canvas. They had to put a new canvas down on top of the ring specifically for the fight, and somehow it managed to go ahead. But Bruno boxed beautifully, as Ian was telling you, in the first part of that fight. He was ahead on the judges' cards, and we all thought, my goodness, the upset is on here. This could be Bruno's night right here. But, you know, he got tagged by that big punch in, what was it, the seventh round. And I always said it was when Frank got pinned. You remember the old Tom and Jerry cartoons? It used to be a little bit like when the cat walked into the ironing board and it went boing, 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 boing. And he didn't take the knee. He didn't survive. He didn't cling on. He took the shot and stood there open, defenseless. And that's when Lewis reined in some colossal punches. And even then, Frank didn't go down. You know, people say he hadn't got a chin, but he was one brave guy.
Yeah, I mean, part of the background to that fight, I think Lennox lifted it about two gears. I think he realised that he was in trouble in the fight and he was going away from him. And I don't know what his corner said, maybe they did a good job as well, but he did come out and really start to mean some business, and he did get it done just in the way that John has described there. But I think, you know, part of that background, because it wasn't like Lennox to do, trash talk ahead of fights. He was kind of classier than that. But that thing about the Uncle Tom, which was that accusation that went, I just wonder whether that was all part of the fact that Lennox probably felt that even after he'd achieved what he'd achieved, that Frank Bruno was still the people's fighter. He was the more popular fighter. And maybe Lennox sort of resented that a little bit, because there was always that thing with Lennox around that time where he was kind of saying, well, is he British or is he Canadian? And all that kind of thing. And Bruno was the popular choice. So maybe if he did come out with the Uncle Tom remark, and I can't confirm whether he did or didn't, but certainly that is now the received wisdom. If he did, maybe it was caused by that sort of undercurrent and background.
It's probably worth a mention here as well that in Bruno's losses up to this point, he's lost to a 13-1 Bone Crusher Smith, who I think only lost before then was in his debut to James Broad, who was a world-class heavyweight as well. Then he's lost to a 24-2 Tim Witherspoon, a 35-0 Mike Tyson, and now a 23-0 Lennox Lewis. So only three defeats between the four of them. So like you said, Ian, at the top, really, it's only the top guys that are getting by Big Frank. But still, Lennox was one of the top guys, and he got past Frank again, and then came a comeback against Jesse the Boogeyman Ferguson, my old friend from over in New Jersey, and then Rodolfo Marin, Mike Evans, And that leads him into this massive fight back at Wembley, where the stars seem to be aligning against Oliver McCall. Ian, did you think it had to be now or never for Frank, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. That was the scenario. How many other fighters get a fourth chance to become world heavyweight champion, having failed with the first three? Not many, but of course, he got those opportunities all the time because he was such big box office, because he sold tickets. It was an easy sell for television. So the nation was hooked. The nation was willing him to do the job against Oliver McCall. And they probably believed that he could do the job against Oliver McCall as well. And I don't think it was a great fight or anything like that night. It was a great atmosphere, fantastic atmosphere, but Frank got it done.
And John, you'll remember Ben and Naz leading the cheers from ringside, weren't they?
They were. They absolutely were. I mean, it was payback time for Nigel Benn being at ringside, just as Frank had been at ringside when he'd beaten Gerald McClellan earlier in the year, leading the support for Nigel Benn there. Yeah, the atmosphere was terrific. Oliver McCall, we knew, was immensely durable. He was very, very strong. He claimed never to have been on the floor, even in sparring, never mind in a fight, either amateur as a pro. He was a slightly unhinged persona, to put it nicely, but he was the champion. And it was Frank's great opportunity. It wasn't, as Ian said, it wasn't a great fight. And I remember commentating that fight on radio. It was the last one Henry Cooper did. And he actually thought, as co-commentator, that McCall had won the fight. I was trying to lead that one, trying to lead Henry away from that conclusion, I seem to recall. But it wasn't by any means an easy night for Frank. It was a real tough, grueling occasion. But when he got the decision and the ticker tape came cascading down into the ring from up above, it was open air at Wembley Stadium, and the celebrations began. You know, I mean, it was like a rock concert, a national celebration, a royal event almost, and a boxing match all rolled into one. Phenomenal atmosphere. And it was the moment of vindication and jubilation for Frank Bruno. And it would have been a very, very hard man who couldn't have looked at him and thought, this is a reward for the persistence and the dedication and triumph over the adversity and the setbacks. This was finally his moment.
Yeah, I mean, it was a dramatic end to the fight, if you recall, John, because I had Frank in a pretty handy lead. And if you listen back to my commentary, I'm saying in the last round, McCall's starting to come on strong and trying to rescue it. And Frank's beginning to hold on a little bit. But by then, he'd learned one or two tricks of the trade a bit better on the survival instinct, Fred, and did hold on and buy some time. And he got through that last round. But I mean, my commentary, so I'm glad I wasn't working with Henry on that one, because I was saying, you know, and with that final bow, Frank has surely done it. He surely realised his dream at last. So I wouldn't have looked a complete idiot had the scorecards gone the other way.
He was fitter, wasn't he, going into that fight as well? He'd sort of learnt survival instincts. But I think with going with George Francis, with whom he was very close, I think that, you know, those runs up on Hampstead Heath and the punishing regime that he put him through, yes, he was always dedicated, Frank, but I think George had almost taken him on to another level. And the matchup with McCall was a masterpiece of promotional work by Frank Warren.
It was. I mean, the other thing I remember about that night very clearly was when Frank had won, he came down and I got to do the interview with him, and he burst into tears. He was in tears of emotion. And going back to the Uncle Tom, the first thing he said is, I'm so happy. I'm so pleased. And please. And he's choking and he's in tears. He's saying, please tell them I'm not an Uncle Tom. I've never been an Uncle Tom. That was the main point he wanted to make, even in that big moment of vindication, as you said. But it was great. And I think we all felt really great for him as well. And it was just for us at ringside. What a fantastic story. Frank Bruno, national treasure, world heavyweight champion at last. And you know what? They can never take that away from him.
You know, Triz, when we look back at long careers, you know, I mean, Ian and I have been doing this crazy old boxing game for a long, long time. Frank Bruno finally doing it on that night in September 1995 at Wembley Stadium. That's going to be one night which, when you're even older and grayer than we are now, that's one that you're going to be remembering so clearly. It was a great night.
Well, Ian, I'm glad you touched upon what a nail biter it was, because even if you go back and watch the last couple of rounds now, you know, there's the you can still watch it with a sense of dread that, oh, it's happening again. Yeah. We've seen it. Yeah. We've seen this on loop. This is what's been written before. So obviously the sense of relief, I think, probably added to the jubilation felt throughout Wembley that night. But the jubilation, unfortunately, didn't last too long, John. There was eye injuries, eye surgery, talk of a detached retina. And then he signed to fight Mike Tyson, which I think was the deal breaker for getting the Oliver McCall fight. He had to defend against Tyson in the first instance, if I remember rightly. So we had Tyson again.
Well, I think that was the deal, wasn't it? You know, get through McCall and the defence is going to be against Mike Tyson. And there was huge money involved in it. But Frank, by then, had these major problems with his eyes. And I think probably if it were now, I doubt whether he would have been allowed to even go into that fight. The fight took place, and, you know, just as Ian had that massive audience in 1989, I had a similarly massive audience in 1996 when he fought there. And Frank, on that occasion, I remember when he walked into the ring, he crossed himself repeatedly as a devout Catholic might do. And Hugh McElvanny came out with that classic line. He said, "Bruno walked to the ring and looked like a cardinal on speed." He would have Frank was terrified. He knew what was coming. I think he feared for his sight and he feared what was going to happen. And as it turned out, it turned into three of the most one-sided rounds you had ever, two and a half of the most one-sided rounds you'd ever see. And the Bruno story came to an end as a fighter that night in Las Vegas.
Yeah, I think he knew that that was what was going to happen. I think it was 19 times he crossed himself on his way to the ring. And I remember we were looking at the monitor because you couldn't see him because it was behind us. And you were thinking, oh, dear. Oh, dear.
Ian, was that the first time that Sky did a box office show, if I remember rightly?
Oh, now you've got me.
Okay.
I think it was a box office show, so I doubt it.
I think it might have been, Ian, because I think that's why we got that vast audience, because Sky were trying to sell the whole idea of this pay-per-view, and there was a backlash against it. So radio, you know, they kind of rewound the clock a little bit, and we did wind up getting an audience of, well, we were told at the time, whether or not it was true, we were told it was an audience of somewhere between 3 and 4 million.
Yeah, I think we got an audience of 24.
Not million.
I can't remember. You're probably right. But look, you know, there's way too many fights on pay-per-view now, aren't there? Every big fight is pay-per-view. And I've got my fears about where that's going to take the sport, but that's another issue.
I was going to say, let's not digress, because there's a couple of things that I want to ask you guys before we wrap it up. Did either of you go away to any of Bruno's training camps in Tenerife or anything like that, where he was preparing for any of these major fights? Do you remember that?
I didn't. Ian may have done.
I think he might have gone out to Tenerife once. Was he out there with Nigel Benn? Because Nigel Benn used to train, used to run up Mount Tide. So, yeah, I think I probably did go out there once.
And, John, you mentioned George Francis. I mean, and we did touch upon Bruno's struggles at the start of the podcast. George Francis taking his own life was one of the many triggers in Frank Bruno's descent, wasn't it? And obviously this resulted in the horrible Sun front page when he was sectioned about Bonkers Bruno being locked up, which I think they might have retracted for a later version of the newspaper. The nation hated seeing Frank come apart at the seams, didn't it?
Yeah, and that particular piece of journalism was absolutely, totally, utterly unforgivable. You know, to actually run a story like that under the headline of something along the lines of Bonkers Bruno was absolutely unforgivable. It was awful. And the George Francis suicide unquestionably was one of the triggers which pushed Frank into a spiral towards mental illness of his own. George Francis had had tragedies in his life. I think his son had met an early demise, and Frank had, he tried to take his own life previously. And then when he took his life, that had a profound impact on Frank. And by then, the spiral was starting to accelerate. I mean, I've had that sort of thing involving people in my life, Tris. And I know that once that cycle of depression sets in to a large extent or a significant extent, it's almost like water starting to go quicker and quicker and quicker and quicker down the plug hole. And it's very difficult to break that cycle.
Yeah, I mean, I think another part of it with Frank is he couldn't live without boxing. He was so dedicated to it that I think even when he'd stopped boxing, he used to go into the gym he had at his big mansion in Essex. He would go down there at 6:30 in the morning and do shadow boxing, and he'd go for a run like his road work, just like he did. So, but there wasn't any fight at the end of it anymore. So it was very sad. And I think, you know, that was a big factor as well. I mean, I just want to say with that, you know, we know Frank's had his problems. And I just wish and hope everything is going to be okay for him. It's gone on for a long time now, and it's not easy. But, you know, I think everybody in the kind of sporting nation loves Frank and wishes him well. I certainly do.
Yeah, here, absolutely, 100%. He gave us so much enjoyment, and we kind of bought into him as a nation and shared his triumphs, shared his disappointments. And then we feared for him when he became apparent and it became obvious that he was suffering from bipolar difficulties. We identified with him, and I hope he knows that so many people in the public were there for him then as well. And as he goes around to this day, still making his public appearances and speaking at dinners and at clubs, I hope he really does appreciate the depth of that love. And I don't use that word lightly, the love that the British sporting nation has for him.
Yeah, and I suppose, Ian, just one more on this, on the mental health thing, is in some ways Frank was ahead of his time in that respect, in the sense that no one knew what he was talking about and no one appreciated what he was talking about. If it all happened now, he would have been dealt with far more courtesy and respect, certainly by the press, wouldn't he?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, going back to that headline, it's unforgivable. Yes, you're right, Tris. They took it out, I think, for the second edition. Somebody at least realized that it was the most insensitive headline you could have ever put on the piece. But, you know, it's part of a wider problem, I think, as well, that if you're a superstar and you're doing wonderful things when you're in your teens and early 20s and you have this career where you're back page news, front page news, you're an A-list celebrity and everything that's brought you in your life, what do you do with the rest of your life? It's a long way down from those kind of heady days. And that's not just been a problem for Frank Bruno. I think it's been a problem for a lot of stars in the sport. And it's why a lot of fighters in particular, I mean, we used to work with Glenn McCrory a lot. John and I know him very well, of course. You know, why he was always talking of a comeback. Because you want to get back to those days again, to those wonderful days in your life. So, you know, as for Frank, he's the wrong side of 60 now, and I just wish him, you know, the very, very best. And, you know, we thank him for the memories.
And John, just one last one. I want to end this on a uplifting note. But there is a lot of pressure attached to fame, particularly back in Frank's day when there were three or four channels on the television, 20 odd people, you know, 10 million people buying a newspaper every day, or, you know, one particular newspaper every day. A household name then is very different to a household name today. So there was pressure attached to that. I mean, we see the upside and the adverts and the relationship with Carpenter and everything else. But, you know, it's an awful lot of weight on a young man's shoulder, isn't it?
It is. And you forget that he was often fighters are there on their own. They have to bear this weight of expectation and of adulation alone. they don't have too many people close to them advising them how they're supposed to behave. And Ian alluded earlier as well to the fact that boxing, to a degree, through pay-per-view events and questionably through the numerous streaming channels and various satellite outlets, it's kind of begun to lose its way a little bit as a sport in national focus. In those days, there was only ITV and BBC who were covering this. So you got a big fight on there and you could get 20 million or more watching it. It was huge. And the stars then were stars like you wouldn't believe. And Frank Bruno was up there as one of the very greatest sporting and boxing stars that we've ever had.
And I think his story, you know, just reflecting finally on it, is that, you know, he won, he made that dream come true, you know, the dust in the mirror, Frank Bruno, world heavyweight champion, against all odds, really, because we never thought he would do it, did we? He did it.
Yeah, I think that's perfectly fair. And gents, this has been a lot of fun, a bit of an emotional roller coaster, really, talking about the great Frank Bruno. I've really enjoyed it. Thank you so much for your company and your time. If you're enjoying Ringside Rewind, please go and give us a rate and a review on your podcast platforms, and we'll be back soon.
Hi, I'm John Rawling, welcoming you to Ringside Rewind, where I'm joined by Tris Dixon and Ian Dark. And we're grateful for sponsorship from Fleet UK, a car and commercial vehicle leasing company based in Hampshire, supporting our programme. Great people who've supplied customers for 20 years or more, including me. Wherever you are, they'll find and supply any car you want and work out financing options to best suit your needs. Fleet UK pride themselves on transparency, trust and fairness in every deal. And you can take it from me, they are brilliant at what they do. Just have a look and check them out at fleetuk.com.